From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present a previously recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is Professor James K.A. Smith, author of You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, inspirational, and informative people directly to your earbuds. And on today's Hank Unplugged, I welcome James K.A. Smith. He is a professor of philosophy at Calvin College. He is trained as a philosopher and has expanded on that scholarly platform to become an engaged public intellectual as well as a cultural critic. He's an award-winning author. He's a widely traveled speaker, and he has written a number of influential books. He regularly writes for magazines and newspapers, including the Wall Street Journal, which I read each and every morning. But the book I want to focus on today is You Are What You Love. It's subtitled The Spiritual Power of Habit. And I think this subtitle is transcendently important, and we're going to talk about all of that on today's Hank Unplugged. With that, I want to welcome James K.A. Smith. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's great to talk to you. Thanks for your interest.
Well, I'm truly interested in your book. As I was telling you before we started the podcast, one of my sons gave me this book, and he was very, very taken by the book for a number of reasons. But in this book, you address the question of what kind of people we must become in order to be effective agents of renewal in today's culture. And you start the book, or maybe I should say the premise of the book, with the notion that we've been taught to assume that human beings are fundamentally thinking things, and you think there's something wrong with that. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, it might seem somewhat counterintuitive to imagine that the dominant working model or assumption in our culture is that we are thinking things. But I do think that there's all kinds of cultural forces that still tend to assume that human beings are kind of information processors at root. That is, we project on human beings this picture that we are kind of brains on a stick, and we imagine that we make our way in the world by sort of rationally processing information and making all of these logical decisions. And I think there's just curious ways that we overestimate the role that sort of cogitation, that thinking plays for human beings. Not that we aren't made to think or that thinking is unimportant. It's just that I think, my proposal is that you might not think as much as you think, or you might not be governed by your thinking and your knowing and your ideas as much as you assume, which is also might be the reason why we get hoodwinked and sort of conscripted by all kinds of other forces that we don't realize.
You know, there are a couple of things that I have said over the years that I'd love you to comment on. I've oftentimes said that if we relegate the Christian experience to a head full of knowledge, to mental assent to logical truth propositions, then we're in danger of devolving into a transactional rather than a transformational relationship with the lover of our souls. And that what Christ offers us is not a mere head full of knowledge, but active participation in the kingdom of God, entrance into the divine life of the Holy Trinity, union with the Triadic One. I think that's in concert, as I understand your book, in concert with what you are seeking to underscore.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a sense in which I think we are both pointing to and retrieving what are really historic and ultimately biblical, but also historically Christian understandings of the faith, which kind of got side-railed in modernity and by the Enlightenment. And we've underestimated the extent to which Christianity kind of remade itself in the Enlightenment's image, even as it took itself to be railing against it. So I think that's exactly right, that Christianity is not just a set of ideas. It's not a list of doctrines. It's not even just a creed. There's a sense in which the gospel is fundamentally a love story. And I don't mean that in a Hallmark, soppy, sentimental, melodramatic way. I mean that at the end of the day, what is announced as the good news is that the one who made me is the one who is also there as the lover of my soul and is the answer not so much to a question as to a fundamental longing that characterizes being human. And so I think to portray Christianity as anything less than that, or to reduce it to, you know, a set of metaphysical and theological propositions, is really a reduction of the gospel and the richness of what God promises in his grace, but also the richness of the human beings, the creatures he has made us as in his image.
You make some very poignant observations in your book. You say, for example, that we're not defined so much by what we know, but rather by what we desire, that our deepest desires are the ones that are manifested by our daily life and by our habits. So our habits and how we go about doing things each and every day tell us a lot about who we are and what we actually love the most.
Yeah, and we should even imagine there's kind of a feedback loop here, so that in a sense, right, so a really core thesis, and I think this resonates with what you were saying earlier too, it's not that human beings are just thinking things. We're not just information processors. We're not just brains on a stick. We are lovers. We are desiring creatures. We are made for the God who is the answer of that fundamental desire. And those desires, however, are also not things that we kind of consciously, intellectually choose. They are inscribed in us and formed in us by the rhythms and rituals and the liturgies that we give ourselves over to. So in a sense, we are training our desires because our desires are habits. And then those patterns of life, those rituals, those patterns of life kind of reinforce what we are longing for. So the pattern of my life kind of manifests what I desire. And the pattern of my life is effectively an incubator of my desire. And so that's why I think people might not realize they don't love what they think, right? There can be this tension and this gap between what I confess, what I profess, what my credo is, and what I've actually learned to love because of these habits of the heart.
I was thinking about your book as I thought about one of my favorite quotations. One of my all-time favorite Orthodox theologians is Vladimir Lossky, and he famously said that Christian theology is always, in the last resort, a means. He said it's a unity of knowledge subserving an end that transcends all knowledge. And then he went on to say that this ultimate end is union with God, or deification, properly understood, being partakers of the divine nature. In this light, you talk about the fact that we act not so much out of our thoughts, but rather we act out of our dispositions, out of our habits, out of our loves. In fact, the subtitle of your book, I think, is poignant and profound. I mean, some subtitles are and some aren't, but your subtitle, I think, says it all. The spiritual power of habit. Talk about the spiritual power of habit.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the affirmation of that intuition, because I do think that in some ways, because maybe, and I say this as somebody who is a Protestant, although not necessarily an evangelical, but I think one of the things that has characterized Protestantism is we have not had an adequate place for appreciating the significance of habit in the Christian life. And so we have always imagined that I need to know the right things, believe the right things, and maybe know the right rules, and then I will choose to act accordingly. And I just think that that seriously underestimates how sanctification works. That sanctification is not just the conformity of my will to what my intellect knows. It is really the reformation of my very most fundamental desires, which is the seat and center of the habits of my life. That is, my life is much more governed by these dispositions that I've acquired and learned, and yet often don't think about. They've been inscribed in me as rhythms of the spirit, habitations of the spirit, that I don't always have occasion to reflect on and make choices about.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor James K.A. Smith. You are what you love, but you might not love what you think. In the book, You Are What You Love, James K.A. Smith shows that who or what we worship fundamentally shapes our hearts. Our sanctification, the process of becoming holy and Christ-like, is more like a Weight Watchers program than listening to books on tape. If sanctification is tantamount to closing the gap between what I know and what I do, it means changing what I want. To receive your copy of You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit, call 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
You are what you love, but you might not love what you think. In You Are What You Love, award-winning author James K.A. Smith shows that who or what we worship fundamentally shapes our hearts. Christians desire to shape culture, yet are often unaware of how culture shapes us, unaware of the ways our hearts are being taught to love rival gods instead of the one for whom we were made. Professor Smith helps readers recognize the formative power of culture and the transformative possibilities of traditional Christian practices, explaining why the church should be the hub and heart of Christian formation and discipleship. To receive your copy of You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.
The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. Angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all the people. Today, in the town of David, a Savior has been born to you. He is Christ the Lord. This will be a sign to you. You will find a baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger." Luke chapter 2, verses 10 through 12. While many of you will soon enter the hustle and bustle of the holiday season, Hank Hanegraaff has penned The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season to ensure that just as you prepare your home for Christmas, you likewise prepare your heart. Order The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season by calling 888-7000-274 or by going online to www.equip.org. Also available is The Heart of Christmas audiobook, dramatically read by Hank Hanegraaff. In his book, You Are What You Love, James K.A. Smith explains that the practices of historic Christian worship are not just old traditional ways that Christians gathered around word and table. They are rooted in a fundamentally different understanding of what worship is. Historic Christian worship is rooted in the conviction that God is the primary actor in the worship encounter, in which God recalibrates our hearts, reforms our desires, and habituates our loves. Worship isn't just something we do, it is where God does something to us. Worship is the heart of discipleship because it is the gymnasium in which God retrains our hearts. To receive your copy of You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit by James K.A. Smith, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. Let's now rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. James K.A. Smith in their conversation.
My life is much more governed by these dispositions that I've acquired and learned and yet often don't think about. They've been inscribed in me as rhythms of the Spirit, habitations of the Spirit, that I don't always have occasion to reflect on and make choices about. And I think Protestantism has always been a bit allergic or nervous in that environment, because if we take this seriously, some people worry that we're talking about works or so, which of course is not the case at all. We're talking about the means by which the Spirit reconfigures the human heart to be one that longs for and is aimed at and directed towards God and his kingdom. In fact, it's interesting. We would have a common point of departure insofar as one of the biggest influences on me as I started this entire project was a little book by Alexander Schmemann called For the Life of the World, who's a brilliant Orthodox theologian. And to me, he was painting a picture of this deep holism of both Christianity and the Christian life. And that the way in which it reconfigures the picture of Christianity as not just an intellectual puzzle to be solved, it's a fundamental human longing for communion. And I also think that really, really resonates in our cultural moment evangelistically. Like, I do think it changes what good news you think you're announcing in the gospel. Because I think this is a much better way to understand our neighbors than to imagine them as intellectual puzzle solvers.
Yeah, brilliant. I heard you mention a number of times in your comments the word heart. And you define what you mean by heart in the book, but I think it's perhaps helpful to those listening in to have a sense of your definition, what you mean when you use the word heart.
Yeah, so I'm trying to invoke biblical language, right? So it's interesting that both the Old Testament and New Testament share this language of the heart to describe now not just this emotive, warm, fuzzy feeling center, but that the heart is this deep core center of the human person. In fact, the Greek term in the New Testament gives this vibe that the heart is like your gut, right? This sort of visceral core of who we are. And that's because the heart is the seat of our longings, and we are what we long for. We are what we love. And this is one of the reasons why I think heart language immediately, even in English, invokes love language for us. And we just have to remember that I think the biblical, and I think this is the early fathers thought the same way, that the heart is really the engine of a desire for God, and that agape love is really rightly ordered eros, right? So that eros is built in as this direction of longing in the human person. So now I'm partial to a Western father, St. Augustine, who's kind of my patron saint. And Augustine, I think, captures this beautifully in the beginning of his Confessions, when he's praying to God and he says, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. And you see this picture that every human being is this heart that is made to long for the ultimate, and the ultimate one who made it, and the ultimate one who is its home. And if the effect of sin and the fall and brokenness on our lives is not that we don't long, it's that we try to satisfy that longing in all kinds of finite substitutes rather than the infinite home that is the triune God that we've been made for. And so the heart language to me is not meant to be set up in opposition to the head. It's just actually saying that even my thinking about the world, even my intellectual reflection on the world, in fact, is shaped fundamentally by what I've learned to love.
You also used the word liturgy a few moments ago. And one of the points that I thought was profound in the book is that when our liturgies are disordered, then they're aimed in precisely the opposite direction that they should be aimed in. In fact, they're aimed at rival kingdoms. Talk about liturgy and your use of the word liturgy in your book, the significance of liturgy.
Yeah. So I'm using the word liturgy kind of with a small L to start, and I grant that I'm elasticizing the term. But what I'm trying to help people to see is that if we are what we love, and if our loves are shaped and trained and calibrated by the rhythms and rituals and practices that we give ourselves over to, then in fact, there are all kinds of things that I do, which aren't just things I do, they are also doing something to me, because they are actually very loaded, communal, repetitive rituals, routines, and practices that when I do them over time are subtly shaping me and training me to love some end, some vision of the good, as if that's what I was made for. So in my sort of shorthand, lowercase L liturgies is just meant to be this broader term to describe love shaping, heart indexing, habit-forming practices that aren't just something that you do, they do something to you in this fundamental way. And I think the hope is that this becomes a sort of new set of lenses for cultural analysis, so that now I look at my everyday life and I look at not just what do I believe and what messages do I affirm and what propositions am I thinking about, but I start to also ask myself, what do I do? And what rhythms and routines and rituals that maybe I never noticed before, that I just totally took for granted as, well, that's what we do, what of those are actually kind of loaded with a rival story of who I am and what I'm called to? And therefore, what am I doing that has actually subtly and unconsciously and yet powerfully apprenticed me to some other kingdom, some other vision of the good life rather than the kingdom of God? And the hope is that that has a certain unmasking or unveiling effect, not to make us hate the world, but to just wake up and realize that my participation in all kinds of cultural practices are not neutral. They can be fraught and loaded and misdirected. And if I thought that I was a thinking thing and I was always just worried about what I believe and what I know, I would completely miss the fact that my heart has been co-opted by these other practices, these liturgies that have been doing work on me for years. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose that leads me to the next question, which is, how do you recalibrate?
Yeah, so let's say the sort of critical side of this analysis is I need to sort of wake up to the cultural liturgies that turn out to not just be neutral and benign, and but may in fact have been disordering my love. But then positively, this is why I think worship is the heart of discipleship. That is, constructively now, we also understand why the greatest gift the Spirit gives us for the reformation of the heart is actually the rhythms, rituals, and routines of the embodied body of Christ, which we call the church. So one of the things I'm trying to argue for is a picture of discipleship and sanctification, really, that makes the gathered, congregational, communal, embodied, and I would say sacramental life of the church the heart of discipleship, not just because you're going to this club where everybody knows Jesus and it's good to hang out, but because it's actually the means of grace by which the Spirit's transforming power is sort of channeled into these practices.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor James K.A. Smith. Our daily commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you the book, You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit by Dr. James K.A. Smith. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The preceding program was pre-recorded. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more.
You are what you love, but you might not love what you think. In You Are What You Love, award-winning author James K.A. Smith shows that who or what we worship fundamentally shapes our hearts. Christians desire to shape culture, yet are often unaware of how culture shapes us, unaware of the ways our hearts are being taught to love rival gods instead of the one for whom we were made. Professor Smith helps readers recognize the formative power of culture and the transformative possibilities of traditional Christian practices, explaining why the church should be the hub and heart of Christian formation and discipleship. To receive your copy of You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.